And you couldn't do a thing about it, though, because we're on when you once you get coming inbound and you're smoking. By the way, when you got to the push-up point, lead would say, all right, let's push them up, and you'd be right at mill power. That's full power without the afterburner. And we'd be smoking along doing about 550, 575 knots. That's, what, about 650 miles an hour, something like that. I mean, so you're really moving. And that was our best defense at that point in time and space, because 650-knot airplanes, that's sort of hard to hit. And so we would stay as fast as we could. And this was a problem for the F-4s that were flying mid-cap, because they could not keep up with us without going into afterburner. And then they're burning fuel like crazy, so their time over target now is very, very limited. And I can remember Robin Oles saying, hey, guys, you got to pull it back. We can't keep up with you. And force commander says, well, do the best you can. Because, you know, that was our defense. He wasn't down there getting shot at with flak. And so we'd come smoking in there, and you'd roll in on the target, and that was a typical thing. You'd roll in doing 550, a 45-degree dive bomb. And you drop at around 7,000 feet. Now, that sounds high, and it is high, and it made it very difficult when you're bombing ballistically. When I say ballistically, we had no computers at that point in time and space to drop those bombs on the. We couldn't lock onto the target, and they didn't have the laser that they had later on, even in the war. We were iron bombing it just like they did in World War II, essentially. And so it's releasing at 7,000 feet was difficult. But the reason we released so high is we were doing 550, 575, even 600 knots coming downhill in the bomb pattern. Remember, we're getting the daylight shot out of us. And so you don't want to get any lower, nor do you want to sit there and slow down. So we try to release at 7 so we could pull out above 4,000 feet, because at that point, now you're starting to get into the smaller guns that could reach up into the lower altitudes. And so then you'd come off the target, you'd do a hard break, whatever your flight lead. Like I said, a flight is four airplanes. Now you're operating as an individual flight. When you come off the target, the force, you're no longer a part of it. You're operating strictly as that four ship. Mutual defense, and you're trying to protect each other's 6 o'clock position in case there's MiGs. Looking for SAMs. One guy, if the outside guy on the left side will be looking this way, looking for SAMs and MiGs. The guys on the right side will be looking the same direction on the left for the same thing. So it's mutual protection. Now, you don't fly tight show formation. Don't get me wrong. You're spread out, but you cover a lot of ground that way. And so then you'd come off the target and you'd join back up in that loose formation. And guys, you're pulling G's, you're moving the airplane constantly. You never, ever, 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 and this is going to come up in a little while, you never go straight and level. And you never pull that throttle back. And you're pulling G's. I'd come off the target every. I don't think I ever saw less than 6-7 G's on my G meter. But anyway, then you join back up, and once you got clear of the target area, you could start to relax a little bit, because the guns were pretty much placed in the high threat target environments. And so now you can sort of back off a little bit, take a breather. Your stomach all of a sudden was not as hard as it used to be, and you try to take a sip of water. I'll never forget one day. My mouth was just like I mentioned earlier, just like cotton. And our water bottle was right about here by the seat, and it's got a little rubber tube, and it comes up, and it's supposed to just go over your shoulder and then where you can pull it up and take a sip. When I put my canopy down, that tube happened to be underneath, and that gum thing was, I couldn't get a drop of water out of that thing. And seriously, when your mouth is that dry and feeling like cotton, you really want some water, but there wasn't any. I just remember that. That's not a big important thing, I don't guess. But anyway, it was at the time, exactly. And then later you'd proceed from there, and you'd go back out, and you'd always hit the tanker outbound. From there, if everything had gone well, and it didn't obviously go well all the time, but if it went well from the tanker, then you headed home. Now you got to remember, you got a bunch of fighter pilots up there that who've just been through one hell of an experience. You got probably more adrenaline pumping through your body at that point in time and space than most people have in a lifetime. Now, that may be an exaggeration, but you really do. And I can remember many times. Once we got across the Mekong and got into Thailand, we dropped those thuds. And that's, by the way, the thud was the acronym that those of us that flew it were allowed to call it the thud. But other people did, but they really weren't allowed to do that. And we would take those thuds down to about 200 or 300 feet above the Thai surface. And we're doing about 500 knots all the way home. And we would be pulling up, going over trees, and right back down. I mean, you're just burning that adrenaline off. And then you'd get home, of course, and you'd come in as a flight of four. You do the pitch outs, just like you see the guys doing here on the, in the formation flights. And then you'd come down. You'd debrief. You'd talk about the mission. The crew chiefs always met you with a cold beer. And you'd go to the equipment shack, get rid of your G suits, parachute, helmet, all that stuff. You debrief, and then you go in. When it's a Hanoi go, then you go back to the big room, and everybody joins back up, and then they discuss the whole mission from start to finish. You know, just try to see if there's any place where something went wrong, or there's some improvements. I mentioned that's what you did if everything went well, and as I alluded to earlier, that was almost not standard. You're generally going to lose somebody one out of at least three missions, four missions. And when you do, if they're in the Hanoi area, unfortunately, and this was one of the hardest things in the world to do, we had to leave them. There was no way to get RESCAP in the Hanoi area. It was too heavily defended. So you'd have to just leave them, and you would go back home. Sometimes, though, the guys would get hit and could make it to Laos or out over the ocean. And so what you'd wind up doing, the flight that generally was associated with the individual that went down would go to the tanker, come back in, and RESCAP him. In other words, try to stay over him, try to locate him, try to communicate with him, and call for the SAR, the search and rescue group, to try to come in and pick him up. If you're over the water, the Navy, of course, handled all that for us. And they were fantastic. They did a great, great job. And if we were over Laos, guys like Dick here, flying A1s, would come in and help keep the bad guys off of our downed pilots. And then the helicopters would come in, and those guys had big ones, guys. There's just no way around it. And they'd come in and pick these guys up, and a lot of times they're getting shot at. And sometimes you didn't get a guy out, but there a lot of guys did get picked up, and it was all because everybody was there doing absolutely the best professional job that they could do, and they all had their hearts in making this happen. And so we got a lot of guys back home and so forth. That pretty much, and then of course, after our big debrief, the Stag Bar was a pretty popular place. And I'll leave it at that.
All right, David, it's 47 years ago, August the 23rd. Tell me about August the 23rd, 1967.
A day I'll never forget. On August 23rd, I was at Karat now. I started out at Tokelau, and they were going to send me back to Yokota. Actually, I went down TDY from Yokota Air Base in Japan, and we got orders back home. And my old squadron commander taking over a flight, over a squadron at Karat, which two bases that we flew the 105s out of. Karat was one. And so I called him up and I said, "Hey, Fox," that's what everybody called him. He had silver hair. And I said, "Hey, Fox, they're sending me back to Yokota. I want to stay there and finish up my 100. He said, "Get your blankety blank skinny ass over here. I'll take care of the paperwork." So I packed my bag. I went over there, and guess who didn't take care of the paperwork? I was AWOL. I never knew it. I didn't know it till a few years ago, in fact. I knew it when a lieutenant or a captain friend of mine, in fact, we went down the same time. There were five of us that went down. And he said, by the way, Dave, I got a question to ask you. And we were talking about me going from Tokelau to Karat. He said, since when do first lieutenants write their own orders? And I said, what do you mean, Dick? And he said, do you remember when you went over to Karat? What paperwork sent you over there? And I said, well, I called Colonel Trays, and he was going to take care of the paperwork. He said, well, guess what? When I went back to Yokota, no paperwork ever followed. And he said, nobody knew where you were. They were all asking, did you go on an R&R? Where did you go? So, anyway, that all dissipated pretty quickly because I went over to Karat about August the 12th, and on August 23rd, it was a pretty big day. I got there since I was already had more missions than anybody at Karat over Hanoi. They made me an immediate flight lead, so I was flying number 3 in crossbow flight. And we were going up on a big railroad yard, Yen Vien Railroad Yard, which is just across the the Red River from Hanoi. And it was such a big target that they actually were attaching 2 F-4 Phantom strike flights along with our 4 F-105 strike flights.